Please listen carefully.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. This is the Road to Chair series brought to you by the Association of Academic Physiatry. I'm your host, Neil Rakesh. I'm super excited for today's guest. She is the Chair and Residency Program Director of the Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation Department at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine. She's also the VP and Medical Director at the JFK Johnson Rehabilitation Institute. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Sarah Cucurillo.
I went to St. John's University in Queens, New York. I'm Brooklyn born and bred, and I majored in biology as a pre-med student, but I also loved education, so I minored in education, and that was a very important component for me, where I started to really develop my love of teaching.
In what at what point did you decide that medical school was the next step? Did you do anything between that?
Yeah, actually, it was interesting because I took CLEP credits and I had APs, and I basically graduated a year. I finished my college a little bit early, and I was student teaching through my minor, and I was offered a position as a biology teacher in an all-boys high school, Holy Cross High School in Queens. And I taught in an all-boys high school, and I absolutely loved it. Loved it so much that I thought, you know, I choreographed the play Oliver for them for their spring play. I went on their Florida spring trip. I was having so much fun that in addition to teaching aerobics three nights a week, so it was really a fun experience. And For a glimmer of time, I thought maybe this is what I'm meant to do. And my father had said, you know, I don't want you to have any regrets when you're older. Like maybe you can teach in medical school. You seem to love teaching so much. And he said, why don't you, you know, not, because I had applied to medical school, got accepted.
Yeah.
And then I took the route of I said, you know what, you're right. Let me go that route. So then I decided to go on and pursue medicine, which I had a deep love for.
How many years were you teaching before?
I actually taught for just the 1 year.
Just the 1 year.
Yeah,
you did
so,
all of that in 1 year.
Yeah, I did all. Yeah, that was a year of teaching at that high school. Yeah.
At that point, you have an insane work ethic. You've developed it. I mean, you started it very young. Obviously, I know you're extremely busy. You're juggling a lot of things, but I mean, is that kind of when you start developing the passion for doing? Balancing a lot of things in your life.
Yeah, I think that comes from my upbringing. I saw my parents just work very hard growing up, and I think that work ethic comes from them, and I hope I've instilled that in my children as well.
So, medical school. Mm-hmm. Where did you end up going?
I went to SUNY Downstate. Interestingly, I got into a few other medical schools, but I come from a very traditional Italian family, and the deal was that you don't leave home until you're married.
So
I commuted to college, I commuted to medical school, and then I actually met my husband as a medical student. He was an orthopedic surgery resident, and 4 years ahead of me. So we got engaged in my senior year of medical school, and then got married during my internship.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How did you, if you don't mind me asking, how did you end up meeting him? Were you doing a rotation?
Very interesting. I was doing internal medicine as a third year.
Yeah.
And I had a patient called Ainsworth Williams, and 16-year-old with a septic shoulder. And I called an orthopedic consult, my husband came. And then every day after that, for two solid weeks, he came I said to Ainsworth, who I grew very, very fond of. In fact, he wrote a rap song about me, Dr. Kook. He wrote rap songs, and he was just a great kid. And I said, Ainsworth, you're just so lucky. Like, this doesn't happen in Kings County Hospital. Like, consultants don't come back every day for 2 weeks straight. And he said, Doc, it's not me he's after. He said, it's you. And it was actually you know, the next day that my husband asked me out. So that's how we met. And every year my husband sends me roses on Valentine's Day. Thank God for Ainsworth Williams.
Oh.
So, yeah, so it was nice.
That's amazing. How did you discover PM&R? Was it, did your husband have a little bit of influence on
actually
that?
My, you know, it's interesting because I had an interest in pediatrics initially, then maybe ophthalmology, then I was really looking at OBGYN as a specialty, and then my husband said, you got to look at the specialty, like all the orthopedists are talking about it, it's a great specialty, it's PM&R. And I said, you know, I have some elective time. Let me set up some electives in Manhattan. And I was doing an elective at NYU, and they set me up with this woman, Dr. Jaramillo,
yeah,
who was a pediatric physiatrist, who was a dynamo. She was amazing. And I worked with her for 1 month. I worked in her clinics from morning till night. We did clinics at Rusk, and then we also did clinics at Bellevue. And I, every day I would come on my commute home, I would say, I've never seen one person impact so many people's lives in such a positive way. Like it boggled my mind what this woman was contributing to the world. And I said, I got to do this. And I sat down with her and I asked her, you know, I said, I really think I'm going to, this is my specialty. I said, I think, and she was thrilled. And I said, you know, and she says, you know, I know you love education. I know you love education. And I said, I'm looking for residencies now. Where should I apply? And she said, I think you should go out to JFK Johnson. It's affiliated with Rutgers Robert Wood. She said Tom Strax is out there and Carolyn McCagg. They both are very big advocates of education. She goes, go out and meet them. And I said, where is this place? And she said, in New Jersey. And I said, New Jersey. And it was funny. But it turned out that I went there, absolutely love the culture. The place has, my whole career has been at JFK Johnson Rehab Institute.
Right.
And I was able to really expand and develop the educational curriculum there. And Dr. Strax wanted me to start a board review course, and that started, you know, board review. And it turned out, you know, from a residency perspective to a career perspective, it was a gift to be actually to find that place and develop my career there.
During residency, and this is, I think at that time, there was no ERAS at that time.
No ERAS. No, you were, it was soon before ERAS came, but you were offered contracts and asked to sign them. Hmm. And interestingly, Dr. Strax, it's a funny story, which we always laugh about. I went and interviewed with him and he said, you need to come here. And I said, well, I have, you know, a bunch of other interviews. I said, I just, you know, for my peace of mind's sake, I really want to go on the other interviews. And he said, I'm from Queens, and I know the type of family you come from. He said, I'm just going to be calling your mom. And he literally, he called my mom every day for 2 weeks. And my mom, who never wanted me to leave Brooklyn at all, she was like, this is a good man. He's a nice man.
Yeah.
And he really thinks that this is a great place for you. I ended up knowing in my gut it was the right place, but I was super surprised because, like I said, it was even endorsed by my mom, so interesting.
And during residency, did anything change in what you wanted to do? What were there any experiences that you found stuck out to you to kind of help guide your career later on?
Absolutely. You know, the first year I was in, and I think this happens to a lot of residents, and I really try to stay sensitive to it, because most times first year is very, if you do inpatients, very heavily involved with medicine. And, you know, I had just done an internal medicine residency at which was pretty intense. And then I came into my PM&R residency, and I'm like, you know, I'm doing a lot of medicine. Like, I want to get the PM&R stuff. Like, I kept thinking back to Dr. Jaramillo and what she was doing. And then I was talking to Dr. Strax about it. And he had said, wait until you're on the consult service. When you're on the consult service, they're going to call you in just for the PM&R issues. And so my first rotation my PGY 3 year was consults, and I fell in love with it. I'm like, you know, they're calling me and asking me I'm working with the vascular surgeons about what the length of the tibia should be regarding cardiac expenditure. You know, I'm working with the orthopedists, you know, and they were very happy to engage the residents and the attendings up on the acute care floor. So we were able to like kind of get involved on the cancer floor, on the stroke floor, and all of a sudden I really saw what the purpose of a physiatrist was, and I really felt that same feeling I had when I worked with Dr. Jaramillo. And I was that we for each case that the thought was, what can I add to this case? How can I make this patient's life better? And it turned out that you know, upon right around graduation, and I also at that time I also started a you know, I was looking at the curriculum, and I started talking to Dr. Strax about how we can improve the curriculum. And he said, you know, all right. I said, I'm just going to do it with my class, and then we'll see how it goes. And it turned out that I worked with the people in my class, and we kind of had a weekly study group, and it worked out. You know, where the study group was, we met, you know, we really bonded really well together, and we all did amazingly on the boards. So he had called me in and he said, what did you do? He goes, two things. He goes, the consults have increased dramatically since when you were on the consult service. And he said, and the board scores, the fact that you revamped the curriculum for your class. He said, I need you. He goes, I'd love for you to do that for the rest of, you know, he goes, so would you like a job here? And so I said, you know, I was just starting to have my kids. I have four children, and I have four children in 5 years. So Ooh. I said, yeah. So I said, listen, I said, because I was, as a chief resident, I was pregnant. And I said, you know, I'd like to work 3 days a week. And would you be able to, you know, accommodate that? And he said, sure, 3 days a week, that's fine. You do consults 3 days a week. A job shared with another physician, Dr. Luciano, and I developed the curriculum. And he goes, why don't you start one of those board courses that you're doing with your class for the rest of the upcoming seniors? So I started in 1991, I started a board review course. And I did that year after year, and generated, you know, I had my notes and generated my notes, the residents were doing, you know, really well on the boards. And he's like, keep doing it. Just keep doing what you're doing. This is great because we haven't had the success before. And then about in 1995 or 96, I started like lecturing at local places, but I started getting phone calls and people asking me, can I have copies of your notes, which was a big binder at the time.
Oh, wow.
So I was sending them to copy centers to get copied to send them out to anyone who requested them. So I was kind of, you know, in 1998, I became residency program director.
Yeah.
In 1999, Demos Publishing approached me, and they said, we heard you sending out these notes to everyone, and people are asking, are you ever going to write a book about it? And I said, I never really thought about writing a book. I said, really, never thought it. They go, oh, you just have to publish the notes. And it sounded so easy, like you publish the notes. I got the binders already done. Yeah. But it was a lot more than that, because, you know, you would pull things from references, but now you had to go back and find every reference, get permission for every piece of art. There's about 578 pieces of artwork, so all the permissions had to be obtained. So so that first edition was, a lot, you know, from going to just publishing your notes to actually executing it, it was a hurdle. But, you know, and JFK Johnson, the administration there, especially Scott Gephardt, was very supportive because we, you know, there was, you know, in helping execute it, because we had some issues with some of the permissions were extremely expensive, and we ended up hiring medical artists to do renditions of them because it was so expensive. And I thought at that point that was a hurdle that we had to overcome, and I was basically going to handle it on my own. But he's like, no, you know, you're part of our department. We will front you the money, and then when you get the royalties back, you give us back that money. And I said, okay, that's great. So what that was for the first royalty check went right to JFK Johnson, and then all the money since that go into my resident education fund. And oh. It funds my residents to, you know, come to come to programs like this, to go, because they get a stipend from the department, but right. we cover the cost in total with the resident education fund, and when, especially if they're presenting, it's and we do it for whatever conferences their work gets accepted to.
So I assume your residents get to stay at the nicest hotels.
Yeah, they do pretty well. They're a great group. They're just really the best part of my job. Honestly, the residents, I just love working with them, and they're to see them go on and, you know, become chairs and fellowship directors, and you know do research and publish, and you know have successful private practices. And we have amazing alumni and amazing existing residents now.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone that's, you know, that's just starting out in writing kind of books, or they're interested in creating a PM&R based book? Is there any advice you could give them? Any pitfalls that you came across that may be helpful?
I would say, you know, you want to find a publisher that's going to trust and want to work with you to execute your vision. They might want to take you down and kind of push you into doing things you're not comfortable with. You know, you realize your relationship with the publisher becomes very important, and they have to understand that, you know, that if you're editor in chief of a work that, you know, that you're going to, for myself, and I can tell you, I work with Beth Barry very closely from Demos, and she knows, you know, how important it is for me to make this all about the residents and make it in an understandable format, and that we you know, put out a quality product. The other thing is that I think, which I didn't know going into this, is that you have to do revisions every 5 years. I didn't realize that, and it sounds like every 5 years. But when you do the review, we're in the fourth edition. We're in the fourth edition right now.
Yeah,
we're preparing it. But you complete the product. You know, you complete the book. It comes out. You have about a year to a year and a half, maybe usually a year to a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and you got to start the next one because it takes you 2 or 3 years to get the next one done. So you have maybe, like I said, a year and a half, a little bit more to not be working on the book.
Wow.
So, yeah, and it's funny because every 5 years, like, things change. Like, medications change. The epidemiology changes. You know, the treatment plans change. There's different things added. Like, when we started, it was really ultrasound was not a big interest of our specialty. And from an imaging standpoint, interventional pain, yeah. Another one that's become much, much more, you know, focus of our specialty in areas like bioethics and things like that. So, the revisions are necessary. We've added chapters, you know, to meet with the additional areas of need for the field.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I get a lot of nice emails and letters about, you know, people that have used the book. So that's a fuel for my soul, as I have to stay up late at night to do revisions and edits. But honestly, we have amazing faculty. Many of them are in my department. We have a tremendous faculty at JFK Johnson, and they work. Each chapter is really done by a specialist in the field, and people from outside the department from our facility, people like Rich Zorowitz and Steve Kirschbloom, and,
yeah,
you know, that have been part of this book from the start. So,
are there residents that are also involved with it?
On every chapter, every single chapter, there's a resident or a fellow, and I do that deliberately because they read the content and tell me, you know, Dr. C, this is not understandable. This is just a little bit too high level. Can we break this down so that it's a little bit more understandable? And I think, honestly, if you ask me what the secret of residents really finding the book useful to them and understand, and even medical students have told me they use it, it's because I have that resident author on each chapter. And to me, I'm like, you're absolutely right. Like, you're totally right. Like, and this is an area that, has, you know, I've seen residents struggle with, and now we have to make this better. So.
No, I think that's good to know that you take that feedback and you try to keep improving mm-hmm. on it. So it's always good to know. I mean, I, as someone that avidly reads your book, mm-hmm. it's immensely helpful. And I think a lot of people learn the basics. I think that's where a lot of us start.
Yeah, and it is a board review book. So
yeah.
Even with my residents, they're expected to read a major text in the field of PM&R. But some residents will tell me, you know, Dr. C, I read your chapter first, and then I go to the textbook, because you kind of outline what, you know, the crux in a very simple way, and then when I go to the textbook, it lets me focus on what I need to really hone in on. You know, it lets me frame the chapter.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, and it's, you know, it was modeled after the original syllabus, which the SAE is made after, and by breaking it down into those topic categories.
Yeah, I think as a generation that grew up on first aid in medical school, mm-hmm. Your book is almost, it feels analogous to that, where all of us start there, mm-hmm. we develop a framework of how we should be thinking about each topic, and then we supplement it with the more in-depth books or journals, just as mm-hmm. you're saying, or just learning on, on the wards.
Right.
So,
and I get feedback that the bulleted format works for a lot of people, so. Yeah.
It's perfect. Mm-hmm. So I want to change gears,
okay.
And I want to talk about the teaching and leadership stuff that you're doing, mm-hmm. and you've obviously been involved in teaching for a long time, but when did you start getting involved in the leadership aspect?
You know, the leadership actually, it happened organically. I started submitting things to the national meetings, particularly this meeting. I have a long-standing kind of a really wonderful relationship with the AAP, and I from the time I was a PGY 3 resident, I submitted and was accepted for oral presentations, poster presentations. So at that level, I was getting involved at the resident level. I went into the early days of PAL as well, and that really inspired me to be a lead, you know, to try and seek out how I can get more involved in the society. Talk at being at the meetings as a resident really got, you know, because it's an academic society and I had an interest in teaching, get involved with the Residency and Fellowship Program Directors Council was very exciting. I felt it was a tremendous service to, I was a new program director in the late 90s. I was like, this is unbelievable that they're giving us this information to really empower us to be great program directors. And you know, you making relationships while you're at these society meetings, you know, people say, you know, I think you'd be great. Why don't you become a secretary, which will elevate you to president of the RFPD council. And then I'll be on the program committee. And so like I said, it happened organically within the society level, and opportunities come up and you're posed with them. And I would love to get more and more involved. And I've been involved in many different areas in the AAP. And then you know, as you're working as program directors, you meet chairs and you start developing relationship with chairs. So I was program director for all those years, and then the opportunity for chairmanship came up in JFK Johnson, and through the through my relationship with the AP, I had known chairs nationally. So yeah. I basically called them and said, you know, listen, this is, you know, I was really happy as program director and consul director. I was really happy. It was a, you know, well, you know, just a really, I was in a good place. But then, so the chairmanship came up, and, you know, I was thinking, you know, I don't know, is this something I should pursue? And I started, you know, seeing and meeting candidates that they were bringing in. And I'm like, you know, the chair really sets the culture and the tone of the department. And I said, you know, I can't really complain if someone's chosen that's not going to meet that culture if I don't put myself in the game.
Yeah.
And so I called chairs that were affiliated with the AAP, and I spoke to them and said, listen, this is something I'm thinking about. You know, you know me, and in fact, before I had the conversations, I kind of sent them a note saying, could you take a look at my CV? And I had conversations with them and say, do you think this is something that is, you know, is within reason, you know, knowing that it's at the medical school and the medical directorship at the Rehab Institute. And I tell you, I got so much support saying, yeah, they should definitely go for this. This is, and they wrote me letters of support from being involved in the society. I had relationships with them that they wrote to the search committee letters of support for me, which I really think helped my case. So again, it seemed to have evolved organically because and I will tell you, I was program director for many years and wanted to, there were certain things I would love to have changed in my department.
Yeah.
But it's much easier to change those things once you become chair. So there's no, you know, you just get, you don't really, nobody have, I mean, you have to deal with the administration, but
yeah.
You basically have a voice and you could go in and advocate for programs that you think are, you know, critical to your patient, to the patients you serve, and to the students that you teach. And really, I've been chair now for 5 years, which has been it's really been an exciting, very full, like, you know, we talked about a lot of titles, but very full experience. And I've been very happy doing it.
That's awesome. Yeah. I think you kind of glossed over some of the parts that I really like is, as you went through a lot of AAP, you probably know AAP as an organization in every kind of corner of it. Mm-hmm. And you've started a lot of things. You've done a lot of initiatives. Is there any initiatives that you've done kind of during your time in AAP that you're really proud of, things that you've changed that you think have made a huge difference on the way we see PM&R?
Well, one thing I'll bring to light is the Women in Academic Physiatry Task Force. I'm co-chair of that with Julie Silver. And, you know, I have to credit Gerard Francisco and the board at the AAP for identifying that as our membership was really expanding, and our membership has grown substantially over the last several years, and women have been the largest area of growth over those many years, so much so that now the ratio of men to women in the AAP is 60-40. 40% of the AAP membership is women. And what was brought to light, and actually Gerard Francisco had identified it, was that there were some areas of concern that women were not being recognized in the way they should. And then the AAMC pipeline literature came out stating that women in academic medicine seem to get stalled at the assistant professor level and don't advance beyond that. Very, very few, only 21% of women in academic medicine reach professorship. And Gerard was saying, you know, us being an academic society. Why is this happening? Why, you know, we should take a look at this and see what we're doing, really, what we're doing well and what we're not. And we should put a task force together to identify that. And once we identify it, let's see if we can put an action plan in place and try and change that trend. So we started the task force in 2016, mm-hmm. and we, with the work of the AAP staff, Tiffany Knowlton and her whole staff, who worked with the task force, which we have a dynamite group of people, both men, women, a diverse group that were put together on this task force that have worked significantly to put together and analyze this data. In doing so, we found areas that we're doing fantastic in, and then we found areas that have been stable and we're doing okay, and then areas that we're not doing so well in. And we published that paper in September of 2018,
yeah.
and it identified the areas that we, it lays all that data out and where we're doing, you know, where those three areas, that how we're doing in each of those areas. And so with those areas that we're not doing so well in, we were asked by the board to put in, to put together an action plan and execute it over the next several years. And I will tell you, since the time of publication, we collected the data up till 2017, but I just presented to the task force 2 days ago the fact that since we started the task force, that the needle is really moving to be more inclusive of women and really strengthen those areas of weakness that we've identified.
Is there any advice that you can offer other women that you said that if they get stuck in the assistant professor position, how is it that they can kind of what can they do to kind
of? So we have, and again, to the credit of the AAP, we have a women's workshop that's been done for the last 3 years that brings together a group of very talented women to address some of the concerns of women in medicine, but part of that is developing a network and supporting those women. But for women individually, one of the things that can help strengthen them and help them best get over those hurdles is to identify mentors and sponsors that will help them navigate through that area where they get stalled as assistant professors, to help them, because there's you also want to have supportive chairs that are going to say, okay, listen, you've been at the assistant professor level for way too long. Now we got to get you moving. We have to move you forward. But in that role, the chair is being more of a mentor and a sponsor and trying to help them move. But you know, women have to, you know, I think just making women aware that this can be a pitfall. Like, don't fall into this and become, you know, that statistic that never reach, you know, that stops advancing. Like, even though you have a lot going on, you know, you should try to make time to continue to move your career forward. So, and some women there's blocks of time where you're not going to be as active as you will other times. Like, I can say personally, when I had 4 children under 5 years old, there was a time where I wasn't as, you know, academically productive as after they went into, you know, full-time grade school, and especially since they've left, you know, now my yeah. youngest just graduated from college and last May, but there's times where, you know, and I think that's the thing that causes women to kind of come off the tracks and not continue on. But that's where, you know, other supportive mentors and sponsors, and not just women being that, but more senior people that can be supportive and help them once they're kind of, help them get back in the game and then continue on their road.
Yeah, and I think you're the prime example. You're an inspiring example of being able to do everything. You can still have children and still advance your career, become the chair of a department. So, and obviously you've been doing an immense amount for the organization, but just I think women in general that are going into the field look to people like you that have done so much, and it helps them kind of push forward as well.
Yeah, well, thank you. And there's a lot of women in our field that, and you know, that's what's great about seeing that women's task force group. You're seeing a lot of women in our field that, and the group will ask, you know, ask very pointed questions of how you handled this or how through our session. So it's been a great asset to the women in our society.
Yeah, and I our RFC elections, the Resident Fellow Council elections, actually just happened not more than an hour or two ago.
Okay.
The majority of the people that are on the board now are actually women, and our new vice chair is also a female.
Wow.
Obviously, Allison Bean was the chair, the outgoing chair. So I think a lot of your efforts in identifying, I know the resident aspect of AAP was something you guys had looked into. So I think a lot of this has made changes that you know, I'm seeing, and I think it's going to be great. It's exciting.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it's great, and the awareness piece is you know, it's kind of like that speed sign when you're passing it and you're not realizing you're going quite so fast. I think bringing that paper coming out and just bringing it front of mind to you know, people in PM&R and people, you know, even when we were analyzing the data, I was not, you know, I wasn't sure that there was real data driven problems, but you then identify them and you see them. So
yeah, and I like seeing things like that for someone that's going through the process now, seeing that you can do something in this organization and it makes changes throughout the entire field. Is inspiring, not just for women, but you can also, the advocacy events that we do in the public policy committee for the opiopiates, inpatient rehab facility, position papers, all of these things are various things that we do at AAP. And I think this is a prime example of that you can make a change by doing something very simple and having an idea, bringing people and rallying it around.
Right.
So I look up to you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank
when
you.
I'm trying to do some of these things. Is there any advice that you can offer to medical students, residents, fellows that are also interested in changing the field? How do they go about it?
Well, part of it, as I said, is getting mentors and sponsors. Another thing is to kind of lean in, to kind of look at opportunities and really, you know, really try to embrace them when they come. You know, initially you're not, you know, especially if it's something that you have an interest in, because you could make a big difference, and passion drives work ethic. Like if you are passionate about something, then the work you do to it to make things happen within that area, it's not as hard. It's definitely much easier to deal with than if you're doing something you're really not interested in. So find things that kind of feed your soul, that you're interested in, and really whether you're looking at getting involved in the society, whether you're looking for a job, you know, I'm a big believer, and even in developing my department, I'll always sit the attending down that I hire and say, you know, these are our needs, but tell me what what really feeds your soul and what's going to make you, you know, really want to wake up every day and come into work and be thrilled about it. And because if you're working in an area that you absolutely love, it allows you to feel like you're not really working, almost, you know, even though we all are working, but
yeah.
you know what I'm saying? So.
So I have one last question. I'd like to end this kind of, this talk or this series with, do you have any advice for any individuals that are interested in getting into the academic realm and going, and trying to become program directors or even chairs or interested in that kind of role? Do you have any advice for anyone?
ideally use all your resources. You know, if you, you know, pull on your background, like if you are an education minor or if you're not, align yourself with, you know, make relationships with program directors that can help you develop and evolve into the type of program director that you'd want to be. Similarly, if you want to become a medical director of a specific service line, you want to, and that's things you can find out nationally. You can find people that do that run great service lines that that you might want to mirror from what they're doing as a program director. Similarly, as a chair, you want to basically, if you are interested in those positions, you need to take time, seek them out, make appointments, sit down with them, talk to them, ask them, and really, I have to say, our specialty is amazing in the sharing of knowledge, in the support and mentorship of people that are up and coming as future leaders, and you know that will they really extend themselves to try and help you advance as you know, as long as you are showing the passion and the desire and the interest in putting in the work that's required to make it happen.
I like it. Wow, that time flies. any last little tidbits of wisdom or how we can find the answers to next year's SAEs?
Oh, yeah, no, I would like to bring up one other topic.
Of course.
About, you know, with all of this, you know, with everything that you've spoken to me about, there is an initiative that I am very passionate about. And that's the research that I'm doing with myself and Talia Fleming, our co-PIs on this project, and it's called the Stroke Recovery Program. And you know, through my work with consults, I've really it became very evident to me that working in the same hospital system, it was quite frustrating to see patients come in with a stroke and then go to acute rehab, and then go to general, you know, outpatient PT and OT and be discharged, and then come back 6 months later with a second stroke. Because once you have a stroke, you have about a 25% chance of having a recurrent stroke. And as I became chair, I was asked to the cardiac rehab program in our facility needed some support, and they needed some input. So I got very involved with cardiac rehab at the time. And we looked at best practice patterns. We looked at the Mayo Clinic model, which they published papers showing that 36 sessions of cardiac rehab post-stent placement had a 45% reduction in mortality. And I'm like, wow, they did this comprehensive program. I looked further and further into it, where they had nutritional support, smoking cessation, dietary support. They had the 36 sessions of monitored cardiovascular conditioning and psychology for them. And, you know, this comprehensive program that was fully funded by Medicare. And it was also reducing the recurrence of additional events. And I was saying, why couldn't this be done with stroke patients? They have almost identical risk factors.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we do a comprehensive program for stroke patients? Because stroke patients are under that umbrella. It used to be called the Medicare therapy cap. Now it's called the Medicare therapy threshold, where they're very limited in the amount of outpatient services that they can receive. And I'm saying, cardiac patients are fully funded.
Yeah.
So it was kind of it really was starting to, you know, those things that keep you up at night. So we decided to start a research project, as I said, myself and Dr. Talia Fleming, and where we do this modified cardiac rehabilitation using a recumbent cross-training bike for the stroke patients. And we worked with New Step, who made a mitt for their hands and a brace for their legs. And it, and they do these, this, they do 36 sessions of cardiac rehab, and we're looking at mortality, incidence of new stroke, readmissions, and functional outcome. And just the preliminary mortality data is really mind-boggling. And it could be multiple, it could be multi, it could have multiple reasons that this is happening, but you know, we're seeing a major impact in mortality, where the American Heart Association puts out data that people that have serious enough stroke to enter inpatient rehab have a 31% chance of dying that first year. Wow. And the group that we put through the cardiac rehab program had a 1.47% mortality. So it's pretty exciting to see that.
Yeah.
So there was a big impact on mortality, and we're now running data on incidence of new stroke, readmissions, and we also found from a functional outpoint, utilizing the AMPAC, they had a full functional level in every area, every domain, ambulation, activities of daily living, and cognitive function. They did a whole level above the people that didn't do the program, because we had a control group.
Right.
And their cardiac capacity, because we used their initial assessment versus their end assessment after 36
sessions,
increased over 113%. So we saw tremendous gains in these patients. But unfortunately, this program is not funded at this point. So we, we're hoping to work with CMS and maybe get an innovation project or bring attention to them for this type of research that we can expand upon and get our stroke patients funded in the same way cardiac rehab patients are funded.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it's pretty exciting. Yeah, we should be putting out our first preliminary paper soon. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, I think this was a really pleasant conversation, and I thank you for seeking me out to have this conversation, I know this takes a lot of your time, so I appreciate that you've done this. I know you've done this before as well, and
yeah,
it's been fun.
Definitely. Thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Sure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for the show today. If you never want to miss another podcast, subscribe to our channel under the Association of Academic Physiatry in the podcast app. Also, don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook to see all the other great stuff that we're doing.